Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Carmen Cusack and Matt Windsman. We review Shuffle Along. Michael weighs in on Long Day's Journey, and tonight, Peter gives us a review of Streetcar Named Desire at St. Anne's Warehouse, and we talk about the Tony Award nominations. Please stay tuned.
To my soul, you got the power, you got the faith, you got the burning fever, you got the light, you got the way, we're never all alone, so. Say, I'm never gonna stay down. You got the night, you got the day. I got the old dark cloud. The sun is gonna shine again. The sun is gonna shine again. The sun is gonna shine again. The sun is gonna shine again.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway for Sunday, May 8th, 2016. Happy Mother's Day. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many of the places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Peter, I don't think that we've talked a little bit about the Theater World Awards, which are coming up.
Yes, indeed. And I would like to say that if anybody would like to attend on Monday, May 23rd at 7 p.m. at Circle in the Square, the home of Fun Home, please email me privately at pfilichia@aol. So if you do that, podcast listeners will be able to attend the ceremony. Yeah, we did pick our 12 people. It was touch and go there for a while. We had a tie at one point. I won't say what happened, but I will say that it really went down to the wire because two people tied with the same number, and one was able to sneak in and one was not, which made me sad because so near yet so far. But we did have 10 winners from Broadway and two from off-Broadway, and we'll see who'll be at the ceremony, where we'll also honor Deb Bernadette Peters with a Lifetime Achievement Award. She was a great favorite of John Willis from way back when, and John Willis, of course, was the power of these awards from the 60s through the 90s, so she'll be there, and a good time is expected to be had by all, so I hope anybody who can come will come and hear me tell a few good jokes, and undoubtedly some bad ones, too.
I think I have a photo of Bernadette with John. I'm going to have to see if I can dig that up.
Oh, that'd be nice. Yeah, yeah.
Can you say, just generally, was there any discussion of the fact that Ben Whishaw already played a major role in an off-Broadway production and was theoretically very, very reviewable in that?
Well, this is John Willis's rule. Since I took over in 96, I have been very reluctant to change any rules that John had in place because it really was his baby. Granted, he was the assistant in 1945 to Daniel Blum, who did start the awards, but Daniel Blum died young in 1963, and John took it over for a third of a century. And his rules were that Broadway was the ultimate. And as a result, if somebody made an off-Broadway debut, he would still be eligible for a Theater World Award if indeed he made if he made an off-Broadway debut, that didn't count against him if he made a Broadway debut. It didn't work the other way around.
I got you.
If you made a Broadway debut and you didn't win, and then you made an off-Broadway debut, well, no matter how wonderful you weren't eligible. But John did have that way of thinking, and I have not. While I don't see the point of it, frankly, I do want to honor John because it really was his organization. So, in fact, one year, ironically enough, John Tartaglia and Stephanie DeBrusso from Avenue Q did not win when they were off-Broadway. The next year when the show went to Broadway, they won. because they were making their Broadway debuts, you know. So so that'll always be a bone of contention here, there, and everywhere. But I do think of this as John Willis's organization.
I see. We had an email back and forth about exactly this, Michael, before Peter and I and one of the listeners. Mm-hmm. And I could see the logic behind it, because if you make your off-Broadway debut, you know, it sometimes is not as widely seen or
sure.
Reviewed.
No, I understand.
That's just my opinion about it. Yeah,
it's just that ironically, to me, he was far better in the other play.
Yeah,
but what are you going to do? speaking of Stephanie, I saw her last night in at 54 Below. Scott Siegel did one of his shows and called Broadway's Greatest Songs, and she performed, and Martin Vidnovic and Julia Murney. And Leroy Reams just, you know, as always, brought down the house. So I hadn't seen Stephanie in quite some time, and it was she looked amazing, and she sang beautifully, and that was really great to see her again. I just, you know, I love that show so much, Avenue Q, and I think that she was such a great part of it. So I always love seeing her on stage.
Me too. I love very much at Avenue Q early on when Jordan Gelber's character talked about being a comedian, and the way Stephanie said, oh, you know, indicating, you know, we all know that could never happen. You know, I mean, she was very honest about that character. And I like that very much. What did she sing, by the way?
She sang, I wrote it down. She sang Someone to Watch Over Me. Mm-hmm. And I have to find my notes. I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's all right. Yeah. I was just curious. And did Leroy do a Jerry Herman song?
Leroy did I Only Have Eyes for You, which is interesting because am I not correct that that was not in the original production of 42nd Street? But
that's correct. That's
but correct. You know what I think must have happened? I think maybe they were going to have it in the original and then cut it because he didn't actually say that, but he said he auditioned with that song.
Oh, I see.
So maybe that's where they got the idea to put it in the second time. Yes. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Mm.
So the Avenue Q team of Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks, I mean, certainly we've been seeing what Robert Lopez has been doing. We got to get Jeff Marks back on Broadway.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Yeah, nice guy.
Yeah.
So I wish him well.
He did have a project recently. It wasn't Broadway, but...
Right. Yeah, something in Hollywood, I think.
Yeah, he's been out in Hollywood for a number of years writing stuff and doing really well out there, but we want him back on this coast.
I agree.
With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Carmen Cusack is with us. Broadway fans know Carmen for her Broadway debut in the new musical Bright Star. Carmen, thanks so much for getting up early on a Sunday morning and talking with us about Bright Star and your career.
Hello, thank you, and you're welcome. Sunday morning, yeah.
Sunday morning.
Hello.
and you had a double.
Good morning. It's all good. Thanks for having me.
For the record, Cusack or Cusack?
It's up to you, Cusack. It's spelled Cusack, so
How would your parents?
Sorry, go ahead.
How do your parents prefer it?
Well, it's not their name.
Okay.
It's kind of an interesting story. I got married really, really young to a British guy, a guy from Manchester. I met him on the QE2 way back in like the way early 90s. And the marriage didn't last, but I kind of dug the last name, although his name was spelled Cusick. And just through the years, I just thought, you know what, I kind of not digging the sick at the end of my name. So I just kind of ended up being Sack, like Cusack. And there were a lot of famous Cusacks. So it just kind of migrated to that way of spelling it. And so here we are. It's not really a fan of my family name at all.
So our Broadway fans will know you from Bright Star, which is running right now on Broadway, but our fans around the world, especially on the West End, know you from a number of productions, including Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, I think that sometimes gets I did Phantom of the Opera on a UK tour.
Okay.
I never went into the West End with that, but yeah, I played at Christine, Phantom of the Opera,
and Les Miserables.
and I miss Fountain, and I miss, it was a weird, interesting story, because at the very end of my contract with Phantom, they were going to obviously see me for the role of Cosette. And because of Christine, you know, she's very high in soprano-y. And I decided I didn't want to be, I mean, I was like early 20s, and at that point I still was like, I'm not going to get boxed into a corner with these little soprano-y roles, because I just like singing all sorts of different things. So I had a chat with the MD and asked him what I should do about kind of mixing it up, changing it up. And he said he'd heard me sing a karaoke song one day, a Whitney Houston Belty number, and he said, well, go in there and just belt a song, use your other range and just turn them and just see what they do. And so I did. And of course, at that point, yes, that changed the game a little bit. But they said, you know, we don't have a full-time opening for Fontaine, but we have an understudy role for Fontaine. And since you're not interested in the cassette, maybe, you know, would you want to step back and play understudy, and then we'll fit you into the role the next contract? And I was like, yeah, all right then. You know, I had nothing to lose.
That works.
And I really wanted to change things up. So, yeah, so that's what happened.
And then you did Secret Garden.
And then I did, yes, I played Rose in Secret Garden. And I understudied Lily in that. And I went on like the third night. It was in Stratford-upon-Avon. It was the Royal Shakespeare Company. And the third night of previews, the gal who was playing Lily got sick. And it was the night of Prince Charles coming to see our show. So, but while I was getting ready, and I hadn't even had a dress run yet, I was doing an interview over the phone similar to this, but while I was getting ready to play this part, I was thinking, how do you feel about performing for Prince Charles? I don't know. I really don't have time to think about this right now. I don't think about everything else. But no, it was lovely, and we met him afterwards. And yeah, that's a beautiful show. Secret Garden, my goodness.
Oh, God, I love it.
It's a beautiful show.
I guess fortunately for you in that case, Lily kind of drifts on and off. She doesn't really interact so much. So I guess that must have made it somewhat easier in terms of this.
Yeah, but she had to be really graceful in a big floppy dress. And I don't know why. I'm a bit clumsy at times, especially on my nerves and Prince Charles in the audience. You know, I think at least I didn't fall off the stage. I think it went all right.
That is great. And back here on these shores, Off-Broadway and Carrie.
Yes.
So tell us, and that's what triggered my memory. I didn't realize that before. That's what I was thinking about before. Tell us about your Carrie experience.
Did you see it?
Well, we talked about it on Broadway Radio an awful lot. It was it was really It was a show that everybody was looking so forward to.
Highly anticipated.
And
yes.
what was your take from on your side?
Well, my take was, you know, it was a real kind of working process, and I kept thinking, you know, with Carrie, my personal view is with Carrie, I kind of thought that there'd just be a lot of blood at some point, and that everyone would have to wear raincoats, and it was going to get fun and gory. But
no, that's American Psycho.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they did it instead. But good for them. But Stafford Arena really just kind of wanted to go in a different direction, and we were all, you know, like, yeah, okay, great, we're on board for that. And I guess after, you know, I think maybe the audience were a little bit disappointed that they didn't get blood stains on their outfit, on their clothes. I don't know. I think that there was a little bit of, you know, but it was a nice little run. And at the Lortel, it was a really cute little venue.
It's a great theater, yeah.
And it was great to see, you know, the excitement on the Chelsea Bernie's face. You know, every time he came in, he really did seem like a boy in a candy store. He just was so excited about it, and I was really excited for him. And we all wanted it to run a bit longer than it did, but you know, got to try and Yeah. Try again.
Oh, absolutely. I missed something on the West End that we forgot to talk about, the Saucy Jack and the Space Vixens.
Yeah.
So, Saucy Jack and the Space Vixens could be another become another cult classic like Carrie became. So
well, yeah, it kind of was. I did that in the West End, and I played this lesbian biker chick called Chesty Prospects. Mm. And she gets killed by the end of the first act, but then is re-envisioned in a different character that's also a lesbian, but a lesbian trucker.
It's
in
like
the second act. It was probably the most fun I had in the West End.
Let's see. Was Carrie your first cast album?
New Secret Garden, I believe, was my first cast album.
Oh, there was a recording of that. Oh,
yes, London, the London version.
Yeah. And so, I've been to a few cast album sessions, and they're so fascinating, but very, very, well, they can be very tense. What have been your experiences with those situations?
Well, I remember my first experience with Secret Garden. There was some issue with equity in Great Britain is very different from the union here. And there were some issues with the negotiations and the contracts for the recording. And so I said, well, if everyone's not happy, maybe we should just have a meeting and air these issues out with an equity representative. And they were like, yeah, they were so gung-ho about it when I suggested this meeting. But then when the meeting actually happened, two people showed up, me and someone else. Wait a minute. So I kind of felt shunned and thought, this equity in this country is very different from equity in the States, because, when a push comes to shove, you really have to stand your ground and fight your cause. And so that was really kind of surprising and to me that's how things were going to roll over there, and some back here. it was a lovely experience to actually do the recording, and I can't say that anyone's really made anything out of it, but things are different now. Music is different. The whole industry is very different. Just got to put stuff out there and hope you get a $5 check in the mail every so often, but it's no big deal.
And how about the Bright Star recording? At what point was that actually recorded?
At what point? It was recorded, yeah. I believe. Sorry, go ahead.
Was it before previews began, or?
No, it was near the end. Well, it was it was midway through previews or just near the end of previews.
Okay.
The penultimate week of previews, I believe, is when we managed to, and we only did, we it was a 2-day affair, and it went really quickly and without any issues. And 'cause, Peter Asher was in charge, and he's the bomb. He's just like a rock star when it comes to producing albums, and he just knew exactly what he needed, and there weren't many takes involved, and Walter Bobby was on site to just to give us a few pointers if the first take didn't quite hit all of the marks. And just the whole collaboration, and Steve was there and Evie was there pretty much through the whole 2 days. It was just nothing but a real love fest in the studio.
Well, they got it out quite quickly, so I guess that indicates that you all did a really great job, and it didn't require a lot of post-production.
No, it really didn't. I mean, literally, I don't think I did a third take on anything.
Excellent.
I think that's how good Peter is, because he can just hear everything that he needs to hear, and if he gets it in the first, if he gets what he needs in the first take, or not, he knew that just two takes was going to pretty much, give him everything he needed. he's just a really fast, incredible collaborator. And it was also, after the first take, you kind of shake out the nerves, because I honestly, I have to tell you, I was a little bit nervous. I'd been so excited about working with Peter Asher, because he's such a legend in the business. So you have to shake out the nerves in the first take.
We should point out to listeners that we're not talking about Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. We're talking about Steve Martin and Edie Brickell.
Yes.
Some of our listeners.
Sorry, I'm on first name basis.
Exactly. And how long have you been involved with Bright Star?
Since its first reading in Poughkeepsie at Vassar Film School there. That was in 2013, on a very, very hot summer. I remember us, you know, all like walking across the campus, and it's quite a large campus, beautiful campus,
yeah.
to like the only cafe across the street. And by the time we get there, we were all like soaked, like completely soaked through our clothes. But yeah, it was lovely. It was a really lovely time. It was very much a learning experience and exciting to be in the room with these people.
As you've been working on it for the past 3 years, how much has it changed? And you know, especially around the time of previews, and you're recording a cast recording. Is there anything in the cast recording that might have been cut from the show that's frozen right now?
In the cast recording that might have been cut from the show now?
Yeah.
After you recorded
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, during previews, a lot of things change in many cases. I don't know in your case.
Right. That's pretty much why they wanted to get the cast recording done closer to the end of previews.
Yeah, of course.
So we really knew what we had. And no, there is nothing on the album that is not in the show. There is one, I think, an extra song that's put on there, The Sun Is Gonna Shine, that's sung by me mainly, that is not actually the show version of The Sun Is Gonna Shine, but we also have the show version, the cast version of The Sun Is Gonna Shine again in the album. But then I think there's a little extra song there that's kind of reproduced for distribution in a different way, and also for like shows like Jimmy Fallon. We had to, you know, kind of rearrange it. You know, out of context of the show, if that makes sense.
No, right. Yeah, absolutely. And now you're into the whirlwind of opening up a Broadway show, releasing a cast recording, and the awards season is upon us. And I'm sure that, you know, we are one of millions of media outlets that's requesting your time. So how are you? Are you in the crazy throes of talking to people 24/7?
Absolutely. It's mad, but it's a good mad. It's in a good way. I've been ready for this for a long time. You know, I've been waiting for an opportunity like this for quite some time. You know, this didn't just come overnight. I've been working at my craft. I know I haven't been on Broadway, haven't been in the States for very long, because I spent most of my, you know, career and adult life in England, but you know, this is always in my head of what, you know, where I'd hope to get at some point in the spectrum of musical theater. And it's what so many actresses and actors just, you know, wait for these kind of opportunities to really create something and then, you know, be with a collaborative team that understands and then starts understanding their voice, understanding their interpretation, and starts writing for them. It's just such a beautiful collaboration, and just completely without ego anywhere, and which is such a rare thing, you know. But I've been ready for this. I've been ready for this for a while. And yes, it's a very busy time, but it feels good. Everyone keeps saying, how are you feeling? How are you rested? I feel great.
I was going to ask you about the working on the West End and working on Broadway. Sometimes we hear very high-profile things about the unions on both sides saying, oh, an American can't work in the UK and somebody from the UK can't work on Broadway without some sort of waiver or something along those lines. Have you ever run into that, or do you have dual citizenship, or how is that working for you?
Well, yeah, lucky for me, I have my passport has a stamp on it called indefinite leave. So I can come and go. I can work in the UK and come and go pretty much as I like. I mean, I should check out my passport and make sure that there's no date on that. But when it says indefinite leave, I think it's kind of, you know, straightforward. Yeah, there are some discrepancies. I really couldn't tell you what they are because I've never had to really deal with them, yeah. Luckily. Mm-hmm.
So you are gearing up for the upcoming week of announcements that is happening, and you had a double yesterday, and you have a show this afternoon, so I want to let you run. But I want to thank you so much for spending some of your Sunday morning with us, because I know that this time is very valuable to you.
Well, that's kind of you. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here, glad to share stories with you. Thank you.
And we want to let listeners know that the Bright Star cast recording is coming out. We'll play a few clips for you on the beginning and the end of this broadcast as well. And okay. you can check out Bright Star on the web, and you can also check out Carmen on the web. We'll have links to all that stuff in the show notes. And Carmen, have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Summertime. You got to fight. You got to say, I'm never gonna stay down. You got the night. You got the day. I got the old dark cloud. The sun is gonna shine again. The sun is gonna shine again. The sun is gonna shine again. The sun is gonna shine again.
All right, with us today, we have a special guest. Matt Windman is here. He is a theater critic who writes for the paper AM New York, and he also is an attorney. He lives in Manhattan and is joining us via Skype, and we're going to talk about his book, 57 Theater Reviewers in New York and Beyond, Discuss Their Craft and Its Future, titled The Critics Say. Matt, thanks for joining us on a Sunday morning.
Thank you for the invitation.
So, you've been a theater critic yourself for how many years?
About 12 years now for AM New York. I started with them as a college intern about a year after the publication began, began writing reviews for them, and then after a year or so became their theater critic, which I've continued to be in that capacity ever since.
And covering Broadway and major off Broadway, or everything, or what's your typical schedule like for a year? Are you covering 50 shows? Are you covering 100 shows?
It can really range. I would say probably by the end of the year, I've covered about 100, because if there are many shows opening in a given week, such as say the week we just had,
yeah,
where we had a Broadway show opening literally every single day, I'll be covering all of them. And other weeks when there are less openings, such as over the summer, I might just have one review come out. So probably on average, I would say it's about two reviews a week.
So let's talk a little about your book. The Critics Say, and what you do is sort of interview the critics for this book about the state of criticism. And what prompted you to make this foray into writing a book?
I began working on this in 2008, a while ago.
Really? Wow.
And this was while I was still relatively new as a theater critic. I had done it, but I was very eager to learn more and really just to meet many of the other critics who I just didn't know at that point. And I figured, hey, you know what? This is a kind of like an excuse to get to know everyone, to learn from everyone. So the very first person that I interviewed back in the summer of 2008 was Peter. We met for dinner on the West Side. I brought along my tape recorder, interviewed him for about 2 hours. And at that point, the book was really just about how, you know, someone became a theater critic, what they look for in shows, which is now about half of what the book is. Anyhow, back to that summer, I interviewed about maybe a dozen people. And at that point, I was about to start my final year of law school. So I was kind of busy also with that. And also, I didn't have a publisher for the book, so it kind of fell by the wayside. The tape-recorded interviews remained in my sock drawer for years. And then about 2 years ago, I was kind of prodded to try and finish this. And what really kind of got me to do it was me feeling so concerned about the current state of theater criticism that, I mean, 8 years ago, I mean, obviously it was right before the recession was to begin, and everyone, of course, you know, theater criticism has never been in a great state in, you know, the past few decades, but it's really gotten worse ever since 2008. It was after then that we started to see some of the major losses, many layoffs since then. And now there is a perception that, yes, theater criticism is in dire straits. And then I figured, you know what? I can use this book as a way to kind of bring attention to that issue and to really explore it. And one question that I asked that all the reviewers is, can you come up with a new economic model for theater criticism? So at that point, I re-interviewed everyone I had spoken to back in 2008, including Peter. I brought on more people. I was very glad to be able to interview Michael for it. And then one of the real changes was I also interviewed regional critics. In the beginning, I had just interviewed New York critics and maybe one or two regional critics who also, you know, covered New York theater, such as, say, Chris Jones or Peter Marks. But then I figured, you know what? There are all these other really well-respected critics regionally. I should bring them into this. So in the end, and I didn't even count up the number of people I'd interviewed until the publisher told me I interviewed in total 57, and they put that into the title.
So that's great. Some of the interviews include Ben Brantley, Charles Isherwood, John Lahr, Terry Teachout, Linda Weiner, as you mentioned, Chris Jones, David Cody from Time Out, John Simon, Peter Felicia, and this other guy named Michael Portantier, who's on the phone with us.
So, I'm getting the book from Matt's publisher, but I didn't have it yet. I can't wait to see it. I, of course, I want to ask, what are some things that, you know, maybe just one or two things that some people said that you found especially interesting or intriguing?
Well, the best parts are when people contradict each other. Right. For instance, in one of the best parts of the book, we have Peter talking, basically defending the role of the critic as a consumer advocate. And then we have John Simon then butt in and say, oh, no, that's worthless. The critic is not a consumer advocate. And John is just, you know, and pretty much in any interjection of John Simon in this book, he just goes wild. He's just like, that is, you know, that's just complete BS. And in another John Simon interlude, and I think, Michael, this might have been you, or maybe I think it was you, where you talk about criticizing actors based on their looks and the delicate, you know, how to approach that. And then John Simon comes in with a full, you know, defense of, you know, the fact that he will criticize an actress if he does not feel that she looks beautiful. So a way that I really tried to craft the book was topically, because I could have just done this by critic, just like, you know, have the Michael Portantier chapter, the John Simon chapter. And I feel like books that I've seen like that, organized that way, they tend to be not very interesting. It's like, you know, here, there, and you're repeating the same questions with each person. Maybe the reader will just – you know, look at the chapters containing the critics that he or she likes. But I really wanted to focus on the questions being asked. So that way I essentially asked pretty much every critic the same questions. And by reading the book, it's almost like you're listening in on a symposium of all these critics attacking the same questions, arguing with each other. So my main goal in taking all these transcripts was to organize them in such a way as to make it a coherent and lively discussion.
Well, obviously, it would have been much easier, much, much easier to do it the other way, but far, far better to do it the way you did it.
So you're the chapters break down in the book on why we exist, how I became a theater critic, education and personality, the theater community, ethics, the writing process, readers, evaluation, crisis economics, online, and then there's a topic called Spider-Man.
Yeah,
Is Spider-Man the before and after?
Well, Spider-Man raised a lot of questions in terms of theater criticism. I'm not saying it was, you know, any kind of because of any kind of aesthetic quality, but based on how we saw theater critics, you know, they had to confront the issue of should we review this while it is still technically in previews? And then we saw so basically that chapter kind of tells the story of what happened from the people who made the decision to go in. Like the very first critic to do that was Jeremy Gerard. Mm-hmm. And we have him basically defending what his decision to go in there, in spite of the requests of the production team of press agent Rick Miramontes to, you know, kind of back off, to let the show breathe. And then after he came in, we had, I think, Linda Weiner, then you had Ben Brantley. And then in the end, the critics are kind of asked, so everything that happened with Spider-Man, I mean, critics kind of entered the news for a bit, you know, in that they were kind of taking a stand against this show that was being perceived as having mistreated them. But really, in the end, did it make a difference? I mean, would the show have just been the catastrophe that it was, even if the critics had not jumped in? Like, did Spider-Man show the critics as having power or being just completely powerless? And one point that I think Matthew Murray made was that they did retool Spider-Man after the initial wave of reviews. So they did have an effect on the show in that if the critics hadn't come in, maybe they just would have left Julie Taymor, you know, in peace to keep working on the show. I mean, for all we know, if the critics had not come in, that show might still be in previews today with her still working on it. But what happened was they pushed her out and they came up with the the Spider-Man 2.0 that then sparked, still unenthusiastic reviews. Although some said, well, at least it's kind of coherent, kind of like, you know, just tame family-centered entertainment. But in the end, you know, the show did not become the next Wicked. It did not make back a cent, and I doubt that we're going to see it remounted anywhere, as the producers were kind of claiming when it closed, you know, in an attempt to put a happy face on it.
Well, Matt, I want to thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning and talking with us. You can check out the book at barnesandnoble.com, at amazon.com, where you can get it on the Kindle or at the publisher's website. I'll have a link to that in the show note. The book is called The Critics Say, 57 Theater Reviewers in New York and Beyond Discuss Their Craft and Its Future. Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you for the invite.
Thanks, Matt.
Wishes in the world.
right. The three of us got to see Shuffle Along, or the making of the musical sensation of 1921 and all that followed. I'm going to take a liberty here and say that I no longer see Hamilton as a shoo-in.
Wow. Wow.
That's quite a statement.
Wow.
Blown away by this. I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. In any other season, I think that this would have won everything. But we'll start off with you, Peter. Why don't you tell us what you thought about this?
I didn't like it as much as you, but I do like a lot of it. Part of my problem is that I'm just not interested in the personal lives of people. This personality. I don't care who's married to whom. I don't care who's sleeping with whom. I don't care about any of that stuff. I'm interested in the work. Whenever I pick up a showbiz biography, I always start at chapter 4 or 5 because I want to get to the work. I don't want to hear about their childhood. I don't want to hear about their mother. I don't want to hear about their divorces. None of that stuff. That does not interest me whatsoever for a tenth of a second. Now, I know that separates me from a lot of the world. That's fine. But so Shuffle Along tremendously interested me at for the first act because it dealt with the work. In the second act, when we heard about UB Blake fooling around with Lottie G, and that's Brandon Dixon and Audra McDonald, I'm just not interested in the problems of, are you going to leave your wife? You know, that doesn't do it for me. Also, the other collaborators are squabbling, and that's of a little more interest to me, but I just seeing them fight wasn't something that was compelling to me either. But that first act is really good because the stories of Shuffle Along getting on are really legion and tremendous. I can fully understand why when this show started in previews it was an hour longer. And I feel bad that so many interesting stories must have gone by the wayside. So one interesting story that walked the plank that I was sorry to see go is that at one point they were out of town, and they certainly, money was tight, and the box office man took the money because he had heard that a horse was a sure thing, and he bet on the horse, and it wasn't a sure thing, and suddenly they didn't have the money. So there were a lot of interesting stories like that that just didn't make it into the show, and I'm sure that was part of that hour that was lost, that there was just an embarrassment of riches, and what can you do? But it is amazing that so much happened here. I mean, even to the point of which this is kind of interesting from New York history standpoint, too, that it was so crowded on the 63rd Street that they finally had to make the street a one-way street. Now, that's surprising to us to think that 63rd Street was ever a two-way street. It's not that big a street. And we have to wonder, I mean, historians will be able to tell us if indeed are all those streets up there near Central Park West, were they all two-way streets at one time? You know, but anyway, Shuffle Along was responsible for making it a one-way street. There was just so many people going up there to see the show. So these are the stories that interest me. I have to say I'm very sorry that Audra McDonald did not get a Tony nomination, and I know that, as she has said to me, nobody thinks I need another Tony, but she's really very good, and here's the way I'm going to put it. She starts off very, very icily. She has had a bit of success, and she knows that it can be taken away from her at any moment, that if she's in a flop, there could really be a Titanic sinking type of thing for her. So she doesn't want to really play ball with these guys. It's the only job that's come along. All right, she'll do it, so on and so forth. And little by little by little by little, she gets more and more interested in the show. And as the success comes, she believes more in it. Now, I'm going to use this analogy. If you leave the show and go to the restroom, when you come back, if you see the expression if you see the expression on Audra McDonald's face, you will know exactly how well Shuffle Along itself is doing in its genesis. And that's what makes this performance really something. So again, I can see where the Tony people would say, well, you know, let's give somebody else a chance this year, and that's fine. But in terms of performances, I think she's doing a spectacular job. I think everybody's very good. I do think another mistake, though, that Judge Wolf made is by splitting up the dialogues when the narration is happening. Four guys, the four collaborators, each have a staccato line, you know. And so we went to Trenton, the next guy says. And then there was terrible, the next guy says. And then we had to work hard. And the point is, it's almost like a tennis match. We have to watch one guy. Oh, who's talking? Mm-hmm. This is information. I don't see any reason why each guy couldn't have had his own paragraph as opposed to his own sentence. I know it may seem that the show gets a little speedier that way, but it's information we need to hear. It's information we want to know. So I thought those were problems. But Slickly directed that first act, I have to say. I was tremendously well entertained, and I think everybody in it's fine, and I'll make a perception that, that for people who haven't yet gone, when you go, see if you agree with me that if there's ever a musical of Andy of Mayberry, and I'm not saying there should be, but if there ever is, see if you don't think that Brian Stokes Mitchell should play the part. Take a look at him. I think he looks an awful lot like Andy Griffith now. We'll see if you agree.
Let me add something in about Audra. On the morning of the Tony Award nominee announcements, somebody tweeted at her and said, anyone surprised Audra wasn't nominated? And Audra responded by saying that Audra wasn't, and Audra is thrilled with the nominations. She is just talented, beautiful.
Yeah, she's a gracious lady.
She's just such a wonderful person. Michael, what did you think about this production?
Well, another thing I would say about Audra is that I thought it was so wonderful the way she – and I let me preface by saying I really don't know a lot about the historical character Lottie G that she's playing. But she did this wonderful thing where her speech was very kind of affected, and I thought that that – came across perfectly as the way like a diva of that day might do, trying to seem somewhat grand. But then that sort of disintegrated somewhat as things started to get worse and worse in her personal life. So I thought that was another really smart choice she made. But related to that, I would say I agree with James about the show in every single department, except I thought the book, the dialogue itself was appallingly bad. I thought it was so stilted and so academic. I did not have a problem with characters at many points turning directly to the audience and delivering information. I thought that was a smart way to kind of condense and give, you know, just give us so much information that we wouldn't get otherwise. Nor did I have a problem with the the American Graffiti style ending where we hear what happens to each character. They tell us what happened to them in years later. But I, even in those sections and even more so in the dialogue, I just thought it was ridiculous. I didn't actually write one down, but there are lines to the effect of someone saying to someone else, your supercilious jejune attitude toward this turn of events is indefensible, or something like that. They're talking like, people who hold doctorates in linguistics and English, and they're just show people. I mean,
well, they may be, but I'll tell you, I like that that approach very much, because as it turned out, a lot of these people were quite educated. They had been to universities, so that struck me as a good thing. It may seem jarring, but they really did have the degrees to support that.
I don't doubt that. I just think that even people like that don't talk like that in normal conversation.
Ah, okay.
And I'm sure he did it to as a backlash against the kind of, you know, stereotypical,
absolutely,
yep, uneducated black, sure, dialect that we know. So I understand it on that level. I just think he went a little too far. And then there were also places where, since there were so many times when they spoke directly to the audience, I wish he hadn't tried to get information exposition into some of the actual dialogue as much, because sometimes it was very, very silly. Like when someone said, you know, is talking to the company of the show and says, you know, this is the first African American musical in 10 years and the first one to feature a love song, or something like that. I just thought that was really kind of clunky. And I wish, I don't recall
dialogue like that in Bring in the Noise, Bring in the Funk. And I'm not familiar with a lot of other George Wolfe's work as a writer. I'm much more familiar with his work as a director. And I do think that directing wise, it was really brilliantly done. And the choreography, oh my God. Savion Glover just did an unbelievable job, I think. And you know, I'm so happy to see that he has obviously such a background in traditional tap and traditional dance forms, as well as the type of new style tap that he has made famous ever since, Bring in Noise, Bring in the Funk, and some of those other shows that he was involved with. That was a surprise to me, and a very, very pleasant surprise. So I was happy about that. Oh, there was another moment I just have to call attention to, and I would think it would have bothered Peter, because this normally, I know, sets your teeth on edge. That scene where they don't tell the story about the guy losing the money on the horse, but suddenly they're about to get on a train to, I guess, the first stop of their tour of the show. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that they are out of money. And so the Noble Sissel and Ubi Blake know this, but nobody else does. And I believe it was Sissel who is about to tell them. And you have a moment where he literally says, folks, I have to tell you something. And he's got a very serious expression on his face. He looks like it's real trouble. Then somebody starts singing. And people start singing, we're going on to the next stop, whatever. And then he turns to one of the other guys and says, tell them, you have to tell them what's happening. And then there's another pause, and everybody looks at him, and everybody has serious expressions on their face. And then they start singing a number again, and everyone forgets about it. I just, come on. You know, people can tell if something is wrong, and they're not going to let it drop like that. I thought that was just silly.
So I think you're going against the mantra of musical theater. Where people break into song here. You either have to buy into it, Michael, or you don't have to, or you can't accept it in any case. That's the Mother's, not the Mother's Day, the, I'm thinking of Mother's Day, because it's Mother's Day, the Sunday buffet that they were having, is that the scene you're talking about, where they're $17,000 in debt?
I thought they were at a train station.
They're at a train station. But, yeah. A better story involves the fact, again, something George may have dropped, but when they were actually at the train station out of money, they decided to pass the hat. They decided to perform, pass the hat, and get some money. Well, as it turned out, the owner of the railroad happened to be there and thought they were terrific and gave them free tickets to go to the next stop. That's a good detail, too. See, it's a rich show, and I would have loved to have heard more of this rather than hear that Ubi and Lottie were having difficulties in their affair. That becomes soap opera.
Yes,
So I mean, look at all these little details I'm bringing up again from doing a lot of research before I saw the show. I didn't know any of this before I saw the show. It's not as if this is a well-told story in musical theater history, and I think it's really great that George Wolfe did the research and said, "Oh, wow, there's a show here." Indeed, there is.
But James, I want to clarify, it's not that they're bursting into song. It's that they never allow someone to tell them that obviously something is very, very wrong. And in fact, no one ever does wind up telling them.
I see what you're saying.
That's what I mean. So, I have no problem with bursting into song.
So I don't think that either one have mentioned Brooke Esmanskis or Billy Porter, which fantastic, unbelievable, and Billy Porter, I can't believe he wasn't recognized.
Billy Porter is especially good in being the hard-nosed guy. There's a moment where somebody complains for a tenth of a second, and he will not have it.
That's at the train station, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really you are fired, and
right.
It's something. He's a man who has his dignity. He's a man who has his principles, and of course, as Brian Stokes Mitchell's character will tell him later, you're becoming part of the problem instead of solving it. So there's that issue as well. Brooks S. Mitchell is wonderful playing the Courts. Now, Court is the same guy for whom the theater is named on 48th Street, playing the son and the father. And in 10th of a second, he goes from the son. It's a wonderful moment. So, yes. And, of course, this is about the fact that white people just don't go to black shows. They will not do it, which is why they wound up in 63rd Street in the first place. So,
by the way, have you – I meant to – actually, I was there recently. Have either of you checked out that site and can tell us what is there now?
I was thinking about it while I was sitting in the theater, but I can't – it must be in between Central Park West and Broadway.
It says it on the faux program that they put inside the playbill. Yeah. My gym is near there. I'm going to stop and see what I think it might be. An ABC building, ABC TV building.
Well, another thing is that whatever this building was on a street where there were a lot of garages and automotive places to fix your car. Mm-hmm. So that was another strike against it, saying nobody's going to go up to that neighborhood. I mean, it's so desolate. You know, if you know places where they do have like six garages in a row and auto repair shops, you know what those vicinities are like. So again, this is what was happening in New York City in 1921. That's where they were. I mean, I guess cars were just really starting, and this was the neighborhood where they decided to do all the fixing. So that's kind of interesting, too, that suddenly in the middle of all this, you know, this desolate area that it must have been pretty – I mean, it certainly wasn't like 42nd Street, that's where they were. You know, so again, a lot of good stories here. So I'm sorry that we didn't hear more of them.
They say it's quiet uptown.
I was going to say another thing I think is really interesting, and I don't think we mentioned this before. I guess we didn't. This musical employs blackface in certain scenes. And I'm sure you all remember the tremendous controversy that was caused when there was blackface in the Cantor and Ebb show, the Scottsboro Boys. Mm-hmm. So I can only assume that there were two reasons why we haven't heard that in this case. First of all, this is probably wrong, but I think the fact that the writers and creators of this show are African-American makes a difference. But the other thing is I did notice this, that they actually discuss the blackface in Act Two and put it in context. And I thought that was one of the strongest parts of the show, that actually they have a sort of a disagreement as to whether or not they they should – ever do that. And so I think that helps, put it in context for the audience. Now, I would say maybe that wouldn't have to be necessary to avoid a controversy, but whatever, you know, if it did, then that's good. And I'm glad that they did it.
So have either of you seen Adrienne Warren before?
Not that I know of.
No, but apparently she's a former student of a friend of mine, and he is just so thrilled. I mean, she was.
She lights up the stage.
She does.
She's really, really amazing. So, and the other thing that I'm not concerned about, but I don't know how it's going to play out, is this Tony Award for choreography. You have so many amazing shows and choreography choices this year. It's just I want Savon to win it. I think that Hamilton's great. I think American in Paris. American Psycho is got great choreography. So
you know, it's true. I think that this must be one of the most competitive categories in recent history. You are so right. And not only that, James.
Psycho's not been nominated.
I know.
No,
that up yet.
It's not nominated.
on your feet, Dames at Sea, Fiddler, Shuffle Along, and Hamilton. I thought that Psycho would be in that list.
I'm glad Dames at Sea is in there.
Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah.
What were you saying, Michael? I'm sorry.
Oh, well, no, I was going to say that, yeah, I don't know how I would pick, and they're all so different.
Yeah. It's just it's an embarrassment of the riches this year. All right, so let's move on. We've talked last week about Long Day's Journey tonight, but Michael got a chance to see it. So, Michael, give us a quick overview of what you thought.
Well, I would agree with Peter that it was the best production I've ever seen, although I think I've seen probably a lot fewer than he. But still, I thought it was extremely well done. I would say that maybe the direction was one of the best things about it. Jonathan Kent, the play is tremendously long. I still think it's tremendously written. It's got unbelievably powerful moments in it. And I realize that O'Neill's point largely is that this cycle of recrimination and reconciliation among the family gets repeated over and over and over again. But even considering that, I just think if there were half of it, if like maybe an hour was cut, I think it would be a much, much better play. The director and the actors involved, Jessica Lange, Gabriel Byrne, Michael Shannon, John Gallagher Jr., for the most part of managed to avoid the really I've seen laughs in some productions of Long Day's Journey because the emotional transitions are really not transitions. They're just like jump cuts. There are several times when literally one character says something like, I hate you so much. I hate your guts. And then the next minute is, oh, I didn't mean that, kid. I really love you. I love you, guts. But I mean, if they did it once, you might say, okay, it is, and if they took a moment, but it's over and over again. And to me, it can become laughable. But somehow they all managed to avoid actual laughter in the audience. Although I will say, a friend of mine who had never seen the play staged, I think he'd only seen probably the movie and then maybe a version of the play on television, but he'd never seen it live. That was the first thing he said afterwards, that those moments are really borderline comical. And I who knows, O'Neill never saw the play or heard it read. He wrote it and put it in a drawer and then left instructions that it should not be performed until after his death. So on the one hand, he might have made edits, but on the other hand, having seen The Iceman Cometh and many of his other plays, I think he would not have made edits. But this cast really plays up everything that is good about the play, and there are so many really, really powerful moments. Jessica Lange, I thought, was superb. And Gabriel Byrne, in what is in many ways a more difficult role, I thought was just as good, if not even better. I thought that it helped tremendously. I really love the fact that he has that light Irish accent. And I don't know if that's – well, I don't know how historical that would have been to O'Neill's father, which is the character that's depicted here. I mean, I know he was an actor and I know he was Irish. I don't know if his accent was actually like that, but it certainly seemed perfect to me that he would be – have become a matinee idol, not only for his looks, but partly because of that beautiful voice with that wonderful Irish little to it. And Michael Shannon and John Gallagher, I heard some criticism of John Gallagher Jr.'s performance, but I thought he was really great. And Michael Shannon actually was the one that I had a few problems with in Act 1, only because I thought he seemed a little too glib. But then in Act 2, I thought he really dug into the character, and he did one of the best drunk scenes I've ever seen, extended drunk scene. And the final member of the cast, I should remember, is Colby Minifee as the maid. But again, really, really well directed and beautifully acted. The set design is gorgeous. They use a little curtain, a very simple effect to really great effect. And I highly recommend this to anyone who's a fan of the play and anyone who has not seen it or anyone who has seen it. I really think that I didn't know if we necessarily needed another Long Day's Journey so soon, although it hasn't been that soon. But now having seen it, I'm really very glad that I did, and I'm glad that it's back.
Well, a few observations on that. One thing we have to remember is that a lot of people don't go to the theater that often. So
sure.
A show coming back, you know, is a wonderful opportunity for them to see it again. My Critzelland column this week, if you want to call it up, any listeners out there who care to, at www.critzelland.com, will find that I address the issue of his wife giving the play to producers long before he wanted to. What would have happened in the 1956 Tony race and Pulitzer Prize race if indeed Long Day's Journey had not been produced for 25 years? And what would have happened in the races 25 years hence? What would have happened there? Would Barry Child have won the Pulitzer, we wonder? You know, so those are interesting questions, I think. And the other thing, too, is last night I was at the Voyage Theater Company, which is on East 4th Street, very much close to the New York Theater Workshop, where they were doing August Strindberg's The Pelican, a 1907 play. And it's so interesting to see how many parallels there are with Long Day's Journey, where you do have a warring family. And we've often heard that Strindberg was a great influence on O'Neill, and you can see it here. I'm not saying he stole anything, by no means. I mean, in fact, ironically enough, The Pelican is a hotter play than Long Day's Journey because it deals with a mother who's having an affair with her son-in-law. So that's hot stuff. But there's a lot of dysfunctional family stuff going on in The Pelican, and it's very nicely done. So if you want to get down there and see what might have been one of those influences of O'Neill, this is a good time to go at the Voyage Theater Company.
Well, that's great. I will throw that into the show notes so that anybody who wants to check that out can do that as well. Last week, we talked about Dear Evan Hansen at Second Stage. I hadn't seen it yet. I saw it this week, and I just wanted to chime in and say I'm looking forward to its Broadway run.
Good.
So, Peter, you got a chance to see Streetcar Named Desire at St. Anne's Warehouse, so why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is a very acclaimed production from England. It's even been done in that National Theater video program that they have. And so I didn't see it there, but I was able to go out to St. Anne Warehouse to see Gillian Anderson, Ben Foster, Corey Johnson, and Vanessa Kirby do this classic play. Well, it's a very strange production. In one instance, the set is essentially a railroad flat. So and for those who don't live in New York and don't know what I mean, it's one room stacked next to each other. So you have the sitting room, you have the bedroom, you have the bathroom, all in a row. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. Now, what we're doing is we're sitting in essentially, we'll call it theater in the round, even though it's very square. The famous Max Bialystock line about nobody had a good seat almost applies here, because what happens is that this railroad flat set is on a turntable, and it continually spins around. It doesn't do it very quickly at the beginning. At the beginning, you even say, is that moving? But pretty soon after, you realize it certainly is. And like if you go to one of those restaurants at the top of a building in many cities that revolve, we have one here. Is that still in operation, the one at the Marriott, The View? I haven't heard about it in years. But anyway, at least there was a time when mm-hmm. – yeah, okay. So that's what it's like. I mean, and so at times you certainly see what's going on, and at times you don't. But if you don't see something that's going on, just wait a couple of seconds and you're going to see it. But the continual spinning is really very hard. Now, the other thing that's very hard, too, is the fact that this is 3 hours and 20 minutes. Okay. Now well, what makes it harder is that this new space at St. Anne's Warehouse, which is very handsome and it's a nice district, and I recommend the Italian restaurant down the street, even though I don't remember the name of it. unfortunately, there are no armrests. So and that's a great way to squeeze in more seats, I'll grant you. So I do caution that now and forever when you go to St. Anne's Warehouse, not just through June 4th to see Streetcar, that you may be a little uncomfortable there because you're cozy close to the person next to you on each side. So that's a barrier as well. However, the play's the thing and so's the production. Gillian Anderson is quite wonderful as Blanche DuBois. What really percolates in this production is in the early scenes when she's complaining about Stanley to Stella, her sister. And Vanessa Kirby usually takes it. Here she's feisty. She is not going to simply let Blanche criticize her husband. And that makes a good deal of difference because at the end, after all, they do throw her out. And this paves the way for her being irritated early on that she wishes that her sister had not come to visit. So that's very powerful. Ben Foster's excellent. Yes, indeed. So is Corey Johnson as Mitch. Nice production. I would have liked to have seen it on a proscenium stage, but I understand, you know, the directors and his Benedict Andrews, you know, wanting to do something different and trying something different. But I got a little dizzy.
I did see the video version, and although I couldn't tell for sure, it seemed to me that because there were so many set pieces that there would have been many times when you could not see what was going on. Did they not have actual, like, walls?
No walls at all.
Oh, there are not walls between the rooms?
I think that there was curtain draped, like a sheer curtain.
Oh, okay. Well, that must have helped a lot. That was my impression, but I'm glad. So you're saying you didn't – it's not so much that you missed a lot, but you just felt that the spinning was –
Yeah, I really got tired of it very quickly, I have to say. My statement that I got dizzy is, of course, hyperbole, but not as much as you might think.
Mm-hmm. It was I wanted to step back for Shuffle Along because I think we might be able to perform a service here. I'm very sorry to say that on one of the theater chat boards, I'm reading about how the sight lines from apparently some people are saying like the first four or five rows of Shuffle Along are really bad because the deck of the stage is so high that if you are sitting there, you cannot see the feet of the dancers. And lots and lots and lots of people are complaining about this. I don't know if it's worse on the sides than in the middle. I don't know any of the details, and I'm not trying to be too specific. But let us just say that apparently there is a real, real problem with that. So if you get a ticket to Shuffle Along, you might want to try not to be in the first few rows.
So we also talked last week about Fully Committed, which I got a chance to see this week. And I just want to reiterate what Michael was saying, was that it's a very, very funny show. Jesse Tyler Ferguson is wonderful. It's a tour de force, and it's through July 24th. So if you do get a chance to check it out, please do. And it was very touching. I had not seen the original production of this, so it was a first time for me, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, they were smart enough to include that bit about how the guy Sam is really trying to get off work so he can go home for Christmas and keeps getting calls from his father. So I think it's really important to have that in there and have some, you
that
know.
Wasn't in the original.
Oh, oh no, it was.
Oh, it was. Yeah. No, okay. I meant from the original that Becky Mode put that in. It was smart enough to realize that it you know, it can't all be just snark and fun.
We
have some emotion in there.
Oh, there's no question the show has heart. I'm sorry he didn't get a nomination. One of our listeners, Brian Brooks, brought up an observation that every year there's some show that's running that doesn't get a nomination, and Fully Committed was the one this year.
Well, and you know, and also just briefly, one of my many issues with the Drama Desk is that the issue is so exacerbated because it's hard enough to try to choose among Broadway shows.
Look at
what James was just saying about choreography.
Sure.
You know, if you then add all of those shows off Broadway and you lump them all into the same categories, it's only natural that some really, really great stuff is just going to go by the wayside and not be nominated at all.
Indeed.
Yeah. I, you know, I, I'm, I'm not sure if you guys ever experienced this, but when I lived up on 93rd Street in Amsterdam, there was only one, I want to say, square foot in my apartment where I got cell phone service. And so I know exactly he was putting the cell phone up on the type of the pipe and standing over there in the corner on top of a chair. And I think that many, many New Yorkers who live in a pre-war building that's very, very thick cement and brick and steel has experienced that. And it was very funny.
And that was very well done because that none of that was in the original. It was, I mean, I guess there were cell phones back then, but it was the birth of it. So I don't think he even had a cell phone. And also the way they just put in a little bit about Yelp and an open table, just enough to make it seem like it really is happening now.
My wife asked if this Sofia Vergara line was in there in the original production. I can't imagine it was.
I think it might have been someone else.
All right. So we've sort of alluded to it, but on Tuesday, the nominations for the Tony Awards happened, and we should have a quick little conversation about what we thought about it. So, Peter, do you want to give us your initial thoughts on it, or should we just jump into it?
Well, sure. Initial thoughts, sure. I wish that indeed Audra and Jesse Tyler Ferguson had been nominated. I also wish that American Psycho had done better because it's a unique show. But I wish Benjamin Walker had been nominated as well because I think he's wonderful in American Psycho. So those are the ones that really struck out to me as being the ones that could have gone differently. None of this is a way of criticizing who did get in. It's just a case of feeling bad for those people who didn't. So those were the ones that really struck out to me as notable omissions.
Michael, what about you?
Well, in the case of Best Musical, I would criticize two of the ones that did get in. I just don't think that Bright Star, and less so School of Rock, really should be there, and certainly not before American Psycho. I really was surprised about that. And I'm curious, in a nutshell, you know, because we could go on and on, what do you guys think is the main reason that American Psycho is not in there? Do you think it's just that the subject matter is such a turnoff to people? Or do you think that they honestly just don't like the way it's written?
I think it could be a combination of both. But Michael, what I fully expected you to say, and I purposely didn't say it a few seconds ago.
Okay.
We live about six, seven blocks from each other.
Yes.
And I heard you, even though you live that far away, scream with delight when Bartlett Sher did not get nominated for Fiddler on the Roof.
I guess I didn't.
And I could hear the footsteps dancing in your apartment for 20 minutes that Bartlett Sher didn't get nominated, which was torture to me, seeing him not get nominated. But that's why I didn't want to say it, because I wanted you to gloat.
Well, that's what makes the world go round, and I am happy about that. But I feel it necessary to say again that I think his direction of The King and I is absolutely beautiful. So I have no explanation for why my reaction was so different to both. Let's put it that way.
So five shows nominated. And
well, that was interesting too. Yeah,
you mentioned Bright Star, Hamilton, School of Rock, Shuffle Along, Waitress, and as I mentioned before, I think that now that I've seen Shuffle Along, it's much less of a lock than for Hamilton than I assumed previously. I loved Hamilton.
One always has to wonder if there are people who go to their ballots and say, well, Hamilton's going to win, so let me vote for the other one just for the hell of it. And suddenly, you know, something happens. When we all go to heaven, that's a question we must ask God. If indeed, how many people won from circumstances like that? I mean, I'm sure people did. So who knows? Maybe, James, you'll be right. And I just wouldn't put any money on it. By the way, also delighted for the Paper Mill Playhouse to get bought as the regional theater. That place has been around for a long time. There's been a lot of good work, and certainly Mark Hobie has done a wonderful job since he took over. We're very, very proud of the Paper Mill Playhouse class for doing new musicals lately, and certainly mm-hmm. doing the classics as well, and being a very nice launching pad. So
I was kind of surprised that they hadn't won it already.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you this. I used to bring this up to Angelo Del Rossi, who ran the place for a long, long time, and he says, we'll never win. We'll never win because our contract is not a regional theater contract. It's a stop contract, and that's held against us. I don't know if that's changed. I have no idea, or I don't know if people just don't care anymore. It was
I think that the paper mill has been doing a lot more partnering with Broadway productions in the time after Angelo Del Rossi.
Yeah,
I suspect that
with Disney and with
contracts
others,
contracts have changed greatly. I think
Honeymoon in Vegas coming in and Newsies coming in and various different things.
Yeah, maybe the Chaz Palminteri show.
Yeah,
still.
Yeah. So
I'm sorry, Jennifer Simard. We all predicted it, so I'm glad we were right about that.
Yeah. Peter was talking about Brian Stokes Mitchell before, and although he's not nominated for Shuffle Along, which he should have been, he's also is going to get an award for his service to the Actors Fund and offstage work, which is really wonderful. I was thinking about it before when you were talking about Brian and Stokes, as we should call him,
yes.
Because he gets mad at you when you call him Brian. So you were talking about his Andy Griffith thing, and I was like, if somebody wrote a musical that was where Barack Obama was the central character.
Ah, yes. Good for you. Right.
He's got that same body frame air about him, you know. And
yeah, he just has to cut his hair differently and get maybe prosthetic ears, and he'd be perfect.
But I think that he'd be perfect for a Barack Obama role right now. So in the Best Play category, Eclipse, The Father, The Humans, and King Charles III. Peter, I'm imagining you're pulling for King Charles III.
Well, it's fine with me if The Humans wins because it's running, and straight plays need all the help they can get because when people come to New York, they mostly want to see musicals. So it's perfectly fine with me if The Human wins, perfectly fine with me if Eclipse wins, because Lord knows it could use the business, and that would certainly be a significant boost for it. I was glad to see The Father get in. I think it's a skillful play, so I don't think it'll win, but I wish it well. So,
Michael, any take on the play category?
They're all very worthy, but you know, this is one of those apples and oranges situations. Yeah. I mean, King Charles III and Eclipsed and The Humans. You know? I mean, they're all great. How do you?
I think King Charles would win if it was still here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really was wonderful, wasn't it?
Yeah, it certainly was. And, of course, the Tonys have a tendency to go for the prestige British plays so when they were around. So I think that could have happened, but it seems like a long time ago suddenly.
In the revival of the play category, Crucible, View from the Bridge, Blackbird, Long Day's Journey into Night, and Noises Off. Interesting. The comedy snuck its way in there.
Yeah, as well it should. Whether or not it's Long Day's Journey or View from the Bridge will be fine with me. I would lean to View from the Bridge because it was so radically rethought. Mm. So, but
and I would say I don't really it doesn't make that much difference to me as long as it's not The Crucible, which should not have been nominated because it's really disrespectful to the author and not the play that he wrote.
I'll second that emotion.
All right. In revival of a musical, Color Purple, Fiddler, She Loves Me, Spring Awakening. So, Michael, what's your take here?
I really loved Spring Awakening. I thought it was a beautiful job. I'm sorry, say the other three again.
Color Purple, Fiddler on the Roof, She Loves Me, Spring Awakening.
Yeah, Color Purple or Spring Awakening would make me very happy. The other two I thought had their moments, but also had problems with them.
What do you think, Peter?
I have a feeling it's going to go to She Loves Me, a beloved show that has never got its due, and this is a way of doing it. It is true that Sheldon Harnick is getting an honorary Tony, and they may feel, well, and that's our She Loves Me, and we're all set there. for me, of course, it would be Fiddler, but it's fine with me if whichever one of them wins is fine with me, because again, Spring Awakening was well thought out in a different way too. So I was very impressed by that, and Color Purple's direction is so different from the original. So I'm fine with whoever wins.
Did you all see, now I'm going to say this and I don't have all the information in front of me, but there's going to be a Bach and Harnick Way?
Yeah. If you want to show up on Wednesday.
Thank you.
At 12:30, Bach and Harnick Way will be between Broadway and 8th Avenue on 53rd Street.
So it's the
back of the 54th, Studio 54?
Yeah, because – and the stage door – wherever the stage door is of Fiddler. So what's that? Is that 54th?
Fiddler 52nd.
Well, I thought it was, you were saying, because of She Loves Me, but I guess
no, it's both. It's,
oh, I see.
Both, definitely both are involved. Wherever the stage doors are, and I guess that's 54th Street, is it?
I've called it up. It'll just give me a second, and I'll have to keep talking.
So it's it's going to be a great season. We will continue to talk about our thoughts about the Tony Awards in over the next couple of weeks, but we wanted to touch some of those big categories right now. We'll talk about the actors in a musical and a play next week. And
it is, in fact, 53rd Street between Broadway and 8th Avenue. And by the way, it's Harnick and Bach Way. So I guess normally the composer is first, but maybe because the lyricist is still with us.
I think so.
Happily. Yes. He gets precedence in this case.
I never know who to list first. I can never do that. All right, so let's wrap up for the day.
Oh, by the way, I wanted to take this moment to, first of all, correct a pronunciation or two that I mispronounced. When I was talking about my trip to D.C., I saw this really wonderful production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof at the Roundhouse Theater, and there is a veteran actor down there, and I mispronounce his name apparently as Rick Fauchet. It's actually Rick Fauchet, who played Big Daddy, and he I'm happy to see that he is – I'm always happy to see him on stage. He really is great, and I did hear – someone behind me saying that they thought he was retiring. So if that's true, congratulations on an amazing career. And if that's not true, I look forward to seeing him again. And also the director of that production, his name is Mitchell Hébert, H-E, accent aigu, B-E-R-T, Mitchell Hébert. And he is going to be seen as an actor in the upcoming production of La Cage aux Folles at the Signature. So I wanted to just make sure I got both of those names right. One of our listeners corrected me, and I appreciate it. And then the other thing is that I did want to mention, we, and especially I, spent so much time lauding the sound design of American Psycho, because I really thought it's a beautiful job. But I realized that I did not mention the gentleman's name, and the designer is Dan Moses Schreier. So I did just want to get those two things in for the record. Thanks.
Before we get on to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, or your Android device, and stream us directly to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do we have an answer to last week's trivia?
Yeah, the question was, this two-time Tony winner last appeared on Broadway in a comedy that had the exact same title as the name of a song in a musical in which he'd starred 10 years earlier. I want to know who the star was, the name of the comedy, the name of the song, and the musical from which it came. And Sam Gonzalez was the first to get it, followed by Jake Leonard, Anthony Snitker, and James Gibson Bray. The answer is Nathan Lane, who last appeared on Broadway in It's Only a Play. And It's Only a Play was the name of a song in The Frogs, in which he had starred earlier. So, this week, what is different about the 34th longest-running musical in Broadway history and the other 33 that are ahead of it? So the other 33 have something in common, but the 34th longest-running musical does not have something in common with those other 33. something very specific. What is it?
All right. So if you have the answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we will let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.